It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In recent years, some counties have reduced or sold their nursing homes because of costs. This week, the Kane system actually expanded with the opening of a new specialty unit at Kane McKeesport. Joining me is Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald. So who exactly is this new unit for, sir?
This is going to be a 45-bed unit that we call post-acute care. So for somebody that might have that has a substance abuse issue, that other facilities wouldn't take them. And now, if they're not being taken by another facility, they would probably just remain in the hospital, and the cost would be much, much higher. So at this post-acute care 45-bed unit at the Kane McKeesport, somebody that has, say, a heart condition but also had a substance abuse issue would be getting the treatment at Kane for the cardiac issue, and then we're partnering with Gateway Health or AHN on the substance abuse issue. So it's a kind of a collaboration of treatment that's going to occur at the Kane.
You said might not get accepted elsewhere. At other Canes or other facilities non-county?
Non-county, no, other facilities in the region.
So the 45-bed unit, is it only for patients at Kane McKeesport, or can patients at other Canes maybe be transferred there? How's it going to work?
They could be transferred there, so it could be. It doesn't have to be somebody who lives in McKeesport or lives in the Mon Valley to be able to use it, as long as they kind of meet the criteria that's set out. And the Canes got, you know, things that they've got to go through the way that the nursing home system is set up in the state of Pennsylvania. But if they do meet these criteria and they can be placed in this unit, it's something that they will do. And this is something that the Canes have done over the last couple of years. They opened the memory care unit, for example, at Glen Hazel and at Scott. So it isn't the traditional nursing home care that we may remember from years and years ago, but it's a different type of specialty unit as healthcare and long-term and independent living care have evolved over the years. Kane is trying to, you know, do the same thing.
You've determined that there are more needs than just some of the traditional that you were alluding to. How did this come about, the recognition that there might be a need, that there is a need for sort of complicating factors other than the traditional maladies, whether it's a heart attack or a stroke or something like that, that there is a substance abuse problem for some elderly?
Well, I think this is really something you've got to give County Manager Willie McCain, and in this case, Director Biondo, as things evolve and things are needed out there, they're always looking to see, is there something that we should be doing that could improve both the operation, obviously keeping cost and efficiencies under control. But I think the manager is always challenging the various department directors to make sure that we're ahead of what's happening in the community.
We know the maladies of the elderly. You mentioned heart attack, could be stroke, could be early stage dementia. It seems extra sad that an issue such as an opioid addiction, a painkiller addiction, a substance abuse problem might be, you know, compounding any of those other maladies.
Well, that's true, and it's not strictly for the elderly. We've seen the opioid crisis that has occurred nationally as well as in our neck of the woods over the last few years, really knows no boundaries when it comes to which population is going to be affected, whether it's young people, whether it's people in their middle age, whether it's elderly, whether it's folks at one end of the economic spectrum or the other end of the economic spectrum, gender, race, religion, it seems to know no boundaries.
How will you assess the success of this unit?
Well, part of it will be, will the 45-bed units, will they be utilized? You know, if you have many empty beds and you only have a few of them that are in need, then it wouldn't be something that we should be providing. But as we saw with the memory care unit a number of years ago, when we opened that up, we weren't 100% sure it would be successful, but within a very, very short period of time, it filled up and the needs were there. You also obviously have to look at the financial model to make sure that works, depending on the reimbursements that we get from the state and federal government and insurance companies. So all of those things come into play. So there's no one metric that you'd take a look at, but you have to look at the overall: are we satisfying some of the needs of the community? Are we being successful in treating the patients that are coming through there? And is the financial model something that can be sustainable by the taxpayers?
operating this new unit at Kay McKeesport is included in your proposed 2019 budget. $932.4 million, up 2.9% from this year. No tax rate increase.
Yes, and this is something I think the folks in the county can be very proud of, that we've only had one tax increase in the last 18 years. So 17 out of the last 18 budgets have been passed without a millage increase.
So it's about $27 million more in expenditures, you're proposed. That means higher revenues. Is that due to higher assessed values of the properties in Allegheny County? Or does it mean that more properties are returning to the tax rolls?
What it means is there's more new construction and more properties that are being put onto the tax rolls. No, there was not a reassessment, so people aren't paying a higher assessment. While the millage would be the same, we haven't reassessed now since the court ordered us to do it. I think it was about 8 years ago now. We have no plan to do so in the future. We've seen more properties come on the tax rolls, and we've seen more efficiencies. The county manager has challenged the department directors to, you know, kind of figure out ways using technology to try to do more with less. So we look for efficiencies on the expenditure side. While we have seen growth on the commercial and residential real estate side.
One of the highlights of your 2019 budget proposal is the renovation of facility in Moon Township for a new emergency services department, including a new 911 center. So what will this do for emergency services? Although the center is going to be farther away than it has been traditionally, Point Breeze, although that's not going to be farther away, I mean, it's not the first responders who are going to be farther away.
No, not at all. And what it's going to do is invest in the future. This is a state-of-the-art facility that's, that we were able to get from U.S. Airways, a $30 million facility that we were able to buy for a little over $1 million, $2 million, with all of the infrastructure that is in place. So it'll be more remotely secure. It's on airport property. It'll allow for, again, the next generation of technology as things continue to evolve to be able to adapt to that. The facility in Lexington is now going to be put on the, you know, used by the city. We didn't own the facility. The city was the landlord, if you will, and we were renting and leasing from them. They'll be able to put that property back on the tax rolls in an area that's, you know, starting to really take off, the North Point Breeze area. So it'll help development, it'll help with jobs, and it'll help with public safety on into the future. So we really view it as a win-win.
So the services, will they be enhanced or just more efficiently done and maybe at a cost saving?
I think you'll see a little bit of both on that side of things. So, but I think it also gives you surety that over the next 20 years or the next 25 years that we're investing in a top-notch facility.
Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin. It's always good to be with you.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Nearly 100 children across the U.S., including a few here in Pittsburgh, are being treated for a very rare, paralyzing disease. Acute flaccid myelitis has no cure, and so far, doctors aren't sure what causes it to strike. Joining us in studio is CEO and pediatrician Todd Willen of Kids Plus Pediatrics. Dr. Willen, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Acute flaccid myelitis, or AFM, reportedly mimics the polio virus. How so?
It does mimic the poliovirus in that it causes a paralytic disease. And so what's most scary and somewhat terrifying about this disease is that kids lose movement, sometimes permanently, in the limbs that are affected.
How does AFM present in terms of symptoms?
So if it presents as an upper respiratory infection with fever, it could look like a cold or sometimes GI symptoms like vomiting or diarrhea. But the main hallmark and what everybody's being asked to look for is weakness, particularly asymmetric weakness. If there's any signs or symptoms of weakness, a leg, a hand, an arm that's just seems weaker, or for sure if it's obviously not moving as well, then you definitely want to notify your doc and be seen immediately at the emergency room.
Your office wrote a note to parents about the disease. What inspired that?
So at Kids Plus Pediatrics, we do a lot of communications with our families via media and social media. Our families have learned to recognize that if there's something that's breaking or something that's urgent, that they know they can go to our website as well as our Facebook, YouTube, Vimeo, Pinterest. We really try and keep families connected through a variety of means.
And with the seasons changing, cold weather moving in, are you more likely to hear from parents this time of year anyway, even if a polio-like illness weren't scaring them?
Yeah. As we head into what people like to call cold and flu season, we do see a lot more respiratory infections. Kids are in schools with one another, and so they're spreading these types of things. So
hold on. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has suggested that acute flaccid myelitis is not contagious, at least not in the traditional sense. For pediatricians and primary care physicians like yourself, is that gospel or is it still kind of unclear?
So again, we're still trying to define the exact cause, which is the thought would be an enterovirus. In fact, enteroviruses are infectious, so you can become infected with them. Theoretically, again, contagious, but where we see cases of AFM, we aren't seeing multiple cases occur in a single household. So, good hand washing and typical measures for respiratory infections and GI infections are highly recommended.
Is there any idea why AFM is striking children in particular?
We don't really have a lot of detailed information yet. Again, we don't even have a definitive causative organism, though there are thoughts as to what might be causing it, as I said, with the enterovirus. So we don't have a lot of detail yet.
I think as a society, we get this idea in our head that, you know, doctors have most of this figured out, right? Is it interesting or strange at all from you as a pediatrician to talk to parents about something that we really don't know much about at this point?
So, yeah, right. This is the interesting part with modern medicine, right? We have a lot of things figured out, and so much so that now we're seeing a backlash against things where we have them pretty well figured out, and you see people now opting out for things that are contrary to medical evidence. In this case, it's fairly rare. We're using really the best tools and research and diagnostic information, epidemiologic information to really nail this down. But we also need to know that, you know, science is constantly being used to define and to answer these questions. But right now, we don't have the answer yet.
So for now, if parents are concerned, what should they do?
So if a child presents with cough, cold symptoms, we would tell them to treat those like we recommend for regular upper respiratory infections. Humidifiers are good to use. We don't really do too much with over-the-counter medicines. Fever still should be treated with fever-reducing medicine if the child's uncomfortable with that fever. Don't forget, fever's a normal way that the body fights off infection. So we don't recommend treating every fever. But if your child's got a high fever and is uncomfortable, it's totally fine to go ahead and treat as directed. And we have those resources on our website as well under our doctor's notes. But again, hallmark here is weakness. If there's weakness, notify your doctor right away.
Dr. Todd Willen is a pediatrician and CEO at Kids Plus Pediatrics in the Pittsburgh area. Thanks, Todd, for coming in.
Hey, thanks so much.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, John F. Kennedy visits downtown Beaver Falls in 1960. The 43-year-old former president was in campaign mode when he made the October trip, meeting with hundreds of supporters in the blue-collar town. A real donkey, symbolizing the Democratic Party, even took place in the 15-car motorcade riding down the city's main street. Kennedy would go on to defeat Republican Richard Nixon 1 month later. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac for Wednesday, October 17th, 2018.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. On November 2nd, John Arway will retire as executive director of the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission after 8 years on the job. But is he going completely willingly? Let's find out from John Hayes. John is the outdoors editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Good to have you here, John.
Good to be here again.
Remind us, what is the role of the executive director of the Fish and Boat Commission?
Well, the commission was set up more than 100 years ago to be slightly distant from the whims or the shifting winds of politics. And its job is water quality, management of wildlife laws, and they have oversight over reptiles, amphibians, those kinds of things. But the executive director sort of oversees all of what they do. The commissioners decide a direction they want to go, and they bring in an executive director who will determine where money is spent, what the focus will be. In his time here, John Arway has really championed a program that would monitor all of the waterways in Pennsylvania. There's tens of thousands of waterways in Pennsylvania that the Game Commission hasn't even been to. They don't really know what's there. If they find populations of native brook trout, that is an indicator of water quality. Has to be very good water to have a breeding population of them. If this program, every time they find a stream with native brook trout, that is a signal to the state, to a Department of Environmental Protection, to research that waterway and set up protections upstream to protect that.
Right.
So that means that upstream from those areas, your farm, you may not be able to do all that you want on your farm. You may not be able to sell it and put, I don't know, hotels along the creek or something. But that's a big deal in protecting waterways in Pennsylvania.
All right. You report that John Arway had a long-running battle with the legislature. Over what, or were there multiple issues? Was it just fishing license fees?
It's even more narrow than that. It's actually the point of the spear is one thing that John Arway blurted out. I'll get to that. For as I said, the Fish and Boat Commission and the Game Commission are unfunded commissions. No money from the state taxes go to there. They're funded by the people who use it.
So their budget comes from those fees, those license fees.
So the money doesn't come from the state, but the state legislature sets the license fee. The license fee hasn't gone up at the Fish and Boat Commission since 2005. That's a long time.
So their expenses could have gone up,
expenses go up. Everything goes up. And they're not allowed to charge more for a license. The reason, partially, it's because legislators don't want to have to tell their constituents, I raised your fishing license fee. So it just goes on for years and years and years. Another part of that is inside politics. Perhaps I'll give you this license fee if you give me that. It's kind of trading. I don't know.
Horse trading.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Or fish trading in this case. Yeah.
But the big issue is funding increase because the Fish and Boat, which runs on a $53 million budget, they also have about $40 to $50 million
in reserves.
In reserve that they use for emergencies, such as this dam that was recently damaged at High Point, in I think that's Somerset County, High Point Lake, had a problem with the dam. It's the dam is owned and operated by the Fish and Boat Commission, and they're drawing from that reserve to be able to pay for that.
Is that why the legislature says you don't need this increase? You've got these reserves.
And Arway says, yeah, but if I wait for you to give me that, for you guys to debate it, it gets worse. So the Game Commission does this too, sets up these reserves so that they can draw from it whenever emergency occurs. Fish and Boat hasn't been able to get the legislature to increase license fees. Arway came up with a lot of ideas kind of around that. He added a voluntary youth license for $1. That might not sound like a lot of money, but for every license that the state sells, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service gives them back more than that. I think it's $4 or something they get for each license sold. So, you know, so that's a new form of revenue that Fish and Boat has since Arway got here. Arway's fight with them came to a peak last fall whenever Arway announced that he was given an order by commissioners to either save $20 million or raise $20 million to keep the agency in the black.
Right.
He told legislators that if they didn't raise license fees, he was going to close two trout hatcheries and one warm water hatchery, and he was going to tell constituents which legislators were responsible for that.
And is that why they tried to force him out in March?
The very next day, or within days, they introduced a bill that would term limit the executive director position to 8 years. Our way was 8 years and 3 days or something at that point. So it's really legislators who do this kind of hardball all the time with each other. They didn't want to hear it from an executive director. So they're forcing him out.
He announced his retirement at the end of July, effective November 2nd. And then the legislature all of a sudden not only agreed to an increase in fees, license fees, but also got rid of that 8-year more limit.
Son of a gun. What a good idea they had just after he made this announcement. They agreed to talk about it, which they wouldn't even hold talks. They wouldn't even bring bills that would fund Fish and Boat and the Game Commission to the table. They wouldn't even talk about it. Now they agreed to talk about it, and they immediately dropped this 8-year term limit.
John Hayes is the outdoors editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. John, thanks so much.
Thanks for letting me be here.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. When you look at the map showing which Pittsburgh Public Schools students are assigned to attend based on where they live, there are a couple of areas that look almost like mistakes. In Belmar and East Hills, floating within the mostly black Westinghouse High School and Lincoln and Faison Elementary feeder patterns, are two islands where the kids are assigned to mostly white schools. As part of our series, Dividing Lines, 90.5 WESA's Sarah Schneider reports that decades ago, children who lived within those islands were some of the first to be bused to schools outside their neighborhoods. A warning, this story contains strong, racially charged language.
Sabira Bushra lives on the same street where she was raised. Her house is just blocks from where a bus picked her up in the morning and took her to schools outside of her neighborhood. In 1965, the Pittsburgh Public Schools Board decided to move Bushra and other black students to mostly white elementary schools to relieve the overcrowded, mostly black Leamington Elementary School. Bushra says the schools in her neighborhood were quality, but there were differences.
You wouldn't know this when you were in the fourth grade, but you would know it in high school. Color and economic resources in your community. So that was the difference.
Rebecca Tardy Brown grew up in the same neighborhood. She remembers riding a bus to a mostly white elementary school and feeling like she didn't belong there.
I remember being called nigger, having rocks and things thrown at our bus, kids not being allowed to talk to us in the classroom, not wanting to sit next to us.
Some white parents protested the move for months, telling the board they didn't want their schools to be overcrowded. Many said it wasn't a race issue, but the two black school board members refuted that. A large group of supporters gathered the night the board voted, chanting freedom and singing "We Shall Overcome." Many of those elementary schools fed into Taylor Alderdice High School in Squirrel Hill, a mostly white school where Bushra and Brown graduated in 1971 and 1973, respectively. Both say they received a quality education, were exposed to opportunities, but faced challenges.
You know, you're the minority, you're in an all-white community, you're bused back and forth.
Bushra remembers parents from her neighborhood patrolling hallways because of frequent fights.
You know, a fight is a fight, so they say, but the fights are racially motivated.
Bushra's neighborhood, Belmar Gardens, is a housing cooperative thought to be the first in the country to be owned by all African-American shareholders who had been denied mortgages by banks. Now, few school-age children live in the co-op, but the island and the island in Lower East Hills became entrenched in the feeder pattern. Both are still zoned to attend Colfax Elementary and Alderdice High School, not Faison, Lincoln, and Westinghouse, the nearby schools in Homewood. The last time the district changed the feeder pattern in 2012 to create more uniform class sizes in schools, the board chose to maintain the two islands in the feeder pattern. Kate Reed was the executive director of strategic priorities at the time and says many students in East Hills were choosing to attend their assigned school, and the district wanted to maintain population.
The idea that you would take away Colfax or Alderdice from a family as their home school just frankly didn't feel good. The idea of taking that away from African-American families felt, frankly, discriminatory.
The student population in Alderdice is half white and 40% black. Just 3 miles away at Westinghouse, 98% of students are black. Alderdice is one of the highest performing neighborhood high schools in the district, and Westinghouse is among the poorest performing, with the second lowest graduation rate. Brown says her parents told her Alderdice was the best high school in the city, so the move was a good opportunity.
I got a good everything at Alderdice, good social life, good education. I had fun in high school. I learned a lot. It got me where I am.
It's impossible to know what Brown's life would have been like if she had gone to another high school. We do know the existence of these islands in the feeder pattern is the result of a city that was once, and still is, segregated. I'm Sarah Schneider, 90.5 WESA News.
Our series continues tomorrow with a report on why Pittsburgh is segregated. You're listening to The Confluence. Award-winning Pittsburgh author Sharon Flake published her debut novel, The Skin I'm In, 20 years ago. The book follows the story of Malika, a smart, dark-skinned seventh grader who gets bullied by her peers. Flake spoke with 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley about the publication's impact then and now.
The Skin I'm In is just as popular now as when it was first published. What is it about the novel that makes it so enduring?
I think in part because there's a little bit of Malika in so many of us. I was just watching a documentary on Lady Gaga in which she said she never felt pretty enough or smart enough or good enough as a musician, which sounds crazy to us because she's so brilliant. But so many of us, I think, struggle in the skin we're in, right? We're comparing ourselves to other people. Someone else is bullying us. We're looking at ourselves and saying we just don't measure up. And we're always trying to find our voice and find our place, regardless of the decade. And so I think that's why it's endured. It's, you know, kids read it and feel like, okay, somebody gets who I am. Somebody reflects who I am. And they're kind of showing me a way to get past and through some of this.
You wrote the character of Malika two decades ago, but she still resonates with young readers. Why do you think that is?
She has stood the test of time in a way I could never have anticipated or imagined. And as we are sitting in the middle of the Me Too movement, which is all about finding your voice and being able to speak your truth, right? No matter what that is, and being okay with who you are, and women feeling empowered and girls feeling empowered. I feel as if Malika's been doing that for a long time. And you merge that, the Me Too and the discussions around Black Lives Matter. And I think as a young adult novelist and as a children's writer, I've been saying all along, you know, and we all do who write these books, that Black lives do matter.
What would Malika say to kids in 2018?
I think she would say, you're okay, that it's hard out here, but hang in there. And speak up, even if you're afraid. I think that's it, that don't wait to be unafraid, because sometimes we wait to be unafraid. If I waited to be unafraid, I would never have written a book. But I, you know, if I jump in the water, I figured out I'm a swim. So I've jumped in a lot of water. You know, I'm still hearing, like I said, from young people who turn 30 at this point, who say, young people who write their college essays and send them to me. And they're about, you know, they're about how Malika and the book changed their life. I felt small, I felt little. People teased me because I was dark. I got the book and it just turned everything around.
Pittsburgh writer Sharon Flake is the author of The Skin I'm In, which was published 20 years ago and continues to be popular. Sharon, thanks for stopping by.
I appreciate it. Thank you much.
Sharon Flake will be reading from The Skin I'm In at Barnes & Noble in Fox Chapel on Saturday. She spoke with WESA's Katie Blackley. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. 2 weeks from today, it's Halloween. Candy, costumes, eerie decorations, parties, and don't forget the music. Rosemary Welsh is afternoon mix host for our sister station, WYEP. She's been producing a Halloween music special for 28 years. Rosemary, you know I'm a Christmas music person. I didn't know there was so much Halloween music till I heard your show.
Oh, Kevin, there are albums that are dedicated to Halloween. There are bands that are dedicated to Halloween. And I think it's a time of year that people just get into the atmospheric feel of the music.
So there's plenty of material for you to choose from.
I'm doing 4 hours, but I could double that.
Okay. I mentioned 28 years. Are there must-play songs each and every year?
Absolutely. Season of the Witch is a classic, Monster Mash, Werewolves of London, and absolutely the top hit is Thriller by Michael Jackson.
Of course, of course. Now, all right, I got to ask you, it's a must. So do you have a favorite? Or conversely, do you have one, I have to play this?
No, I think they're all fun, so I don't have a problem playing any of them. But I have to juggle and figure out which to play. But there's a couple that I always really love. Kirsty MacColl has a song called Halloween. But there's another really beautiful song by a band called Seawolf called Leaves in the River. And it takes place after a party. It's close to midnight on Halloween. And it's about a boy and a girl walking through the rain home from the party.
The music's great. But your show also includes stories, memories.
Absolutely. We have people who have talked about some of their favorite songs, their favorite movies, television shows, favorite costumes. We've had some incredible stories about mishaps in a snowy Halloween situation. So tons of great, funny stories.
A little example?
Well, you know, our own Megan Harris here, the producer of this show, has a great story about her family maybe overdoing Halloween decorations.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to 2 weeks from today, Rosemary Welsh, her annual Halloween music special on 91.3 WIP. Thanks, Rosemary.
Oh, absolutely. I look forward to bringing you the music.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.